Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Athletic.
Most of us can only dream of owning a football club, but for the very rich, it's an opportunity towards power, influence, and even more money. So who are the people that try to buy football clubs? And how do football's authorities decide who gets the green light for a takeover? I'm Ayo Akinwolere. Welcome to the Athletic FC podcast. Okay, so here for this one, we have The Athletic's Adam Crafton. Let's not forget, newly crowned Sports Writer of the Year, Adam Crafton. And also, Matt, don't think I forgot the Silver Sports News Reporter category as well. We ain't going to forget you as well, sir.
First loser.
Congratulations to you both. Right, let's talk about this series, right? Men who want to buy English football clubs. And it's been running across The Athletic all this week. You've both contributed to it. So, Matt, let's start with you on this one. What has this series told us about the characters who want to get involved in owning English football clubs in particular?
Well, there's an awful lot of clubs out there. There's lots of buyers, good, bad and indifferent. People get into it for a whole host of reasons. There is no one type of buyer. And I'm afraid to say there's no one type of rogue buyer either. You know, they are motivated by different things. You know, what have we learned? Well, look, owning a football club is pretty cool, isn't it? It's pretty exciting. You know, particularly if you weren't sort of good enough to play the game. You know, it's sort of like the closest thing, right? It's competition. It's exciting. It makes you famous, so that's good if that's what you're into. It can, you know, so it gives you a platform if you've got something else to sell, perhaps. Football clubs often come with stadiums and bits of property. So maybe you don't fancy the football club that much, but you quite like the property. Football clubs are cash businesses. Cash businesses like nightclubs and taxi ranks and all that sort of stuff are quite good for laundering cash. That could be attractive to a certain type of person. Another type of laundering, kind of connected to the sort of making you famous thing. It can perhaps distract attention away from something you don't want us to talk about. So, yeah, there's a variety of reasons. And I think the people we've focused on this week almost sort of tick most of those boxes. Not all of them, but, you know, there's quite a few of the boxes ticks this week. So, look, there's no one type of owner. There's no one type of there's no one motivation. There's no one type of rogue. There's a variety of reasons to own football clubs.
Yeah, Adam, you spoke to Thomas Ziliakis, I think there's a line in it that really tickled us. You know, suddenly a nobody in football terms at least became a somebody. Is there an element of, you know, these kind of guys wanting to be somebody, to be associated with grand clubs like Manchester United or Inter Milan, for instance, in this case?
Yeah, I mean this guy... I mean, even after kind of working on him sort of for the past week or so, he's still a little bit of a mystery, even having spoken to him for quite a long time and received some very long email responses as well. He did come from nowhere in a football sense. You know, I'm not really sure of anyone who before, certainly in English football, before March last year, was aware of Thomas Ziliakis from a football sense. You know, if you'd have said to Matt, give us a list of the 20 most likely people to come in and buy a football club over the next 5 years, he would not have been on it, right? He wouldn't have been on the 200 list, to be honest. And all of a sudden, he issues this press release to say, I've put in a bid to buy Manchester United. My company can put in half the money, or my partners can put in half the money. Then the fans will come up with the rest of the money. And in some ways, what he was saying, when you actually look at that press release, would have appealed, you know, to a lot of football fans, in the sense of when he then went on to explain it, he said, actually, no, we will buy the club and then we'll give supporters the chance to buy some shares and have a say in the strategic direction of the club. A lot of the things that for a long time, you know, he was saying things like, no more sheikhs, no more oligarchs, give power back to the fans. You know, pretty good communications. But there was kind of red flags around it from the start. I mean, he put his mobile phone number on the press release. This is not something that normally happens. We complain about the lack of access we get in sports journalism to owners and principals and all this kind of thing. But does someone with access to billions put their mobile phone and put an email address on a press release? Not sure. So he did that, but he got a lot of publicity out of it. BBC interviewed him. Some leading fanzines interviewed him. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were talking to someone who had said he'd bid for Manchester United. Yet within 3 weeks, he was out of the race, right? And, you know, I think from the conversations that, certainly from the conversations that Matt's had and I've had as well, you know, I don't think that bid was taken particularly seriously. He says that was because he came in very late in the day. Then you question, well, why did you come in so late in the day and make such a public show of it when it was never really likely? But even now, you know, he continues to kind of flirt with the idea of buying Inter Milan, says he put an offer in July and November. The major problem he has is that, and it's a pretty big problem, he's a wanted man in Singapore. He's got an Interpol red notice against him, and he was accused of fraud in a civil lawsuit in New York in the United States, which he settled. He says that was to reduce legal costs. You know, I spoke to the lawyer who was representing the two brothers that were suing, and they have a very different take on that, which is, you know, that they say, you know, that what's going on now in Singapore justifies the action that was being taken at the time for, you know, in alleging fraud. So very, very kind of fascinating situation. But I still couldn't really tell you now, because I suppose it is still a live thing, right? He could be, you know, his argument is you've stumbled across Singapore, New York, these two unfortunate things that have happened in my very respectable 40 years in business, and you're making a whole thing about it and killing me. But they're pretty big things if you want to own a football club, right? And the upside, I suppose, of owning a football club could be associating yourself with these major brands, giving businesses that you're trying to raise capital from the perception that you're very successful and credible. The downside is that association, particularly with Manchester United, everything becomes a story with Manchester United. So if you have got something murky going on in Singapore or in New York 5 years ago, then that is going to come out at some stage. And I think that's what we've seen, the kind of risk and reward over the past week. When you look at some of these stories, Matt will talk about Dozy, it kind of all came tumbling down, and you wonder the extent to which making himself so public around being trying to be involved in a Premier League football club probably accelerated that demise.
Matt, hold on. I'm going to come to you and talk about Dozy in just a second. And before we move any further, we must also say that Thomas Ziliakis has strongly denied any accusations against him. Very quickly, Adam, in terms of social media, I don't know. I look at these men and I wonder if they remind me of those guys you see on social media who are stood in front of a Ferrari saying they will make us rich in quick steps. You know, how big does social media play a part in what these guys are trying to do when it comes to football clubs?
It depends on the guy, right? Like, so, you know, we worked on a story last year about this guy, Henry Maurice, who, it sounds ridiculous now, but he was rivaling the Saudi Public Investment Fund to try and buy Newcastle United. He got in the room with advisors to Mike Ashley, you know, Flanell's, the London offices of Mike Ashley. He convinced journalists that he was really credible. Turns out he's in prison, you know, by the time we were doing a story on him for fraud. But he was never someone that was all over social media. So not everyone uses it that way. I think Ziliakis has used social media in quite an interesting way. He's used some kind of paid for news wires to put out a certain perception of himself. And on social media, you know, I think he realized that with a fan base like Manchester United, you know, if you use two or three buzzwords, you know, the main one being the Glazers are bad, and let's get in a Twitter space and talk about how bad this sales process is, and here's the things that we could do to change the club. Oh, and by the way, you know, Sheikh Jassim and Sir Jim Ratcliffe, yeah, I'll go into business with both of them. You know, if they need a partner, I'm here, right? You know, if they don't need a front man, I'm around, you know. I'm not arriving at them. I'm here, you know, we can do this together. So I think some of them do use it that way, but also a lot of them that don't use social media at all, actually, and almost hide from social media because they know that actually with a little bit of scrutiny, because there's some pretty good kind of startup amateur journalists on Twitter now. Every football fan listening to this will know that one supporter from their club who you can trust on the kind of the football business, right? I think the social media side can be a risk as well as reward for them.
You're listening to the Athletic FC podcast with Ayo Akinwolere. This is a paid advertisement from Better Health Therapy Online. Do you ever get that feeling that you need to get something off your chest? We all carry around different stressors, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe place to release and discuss those thoughts and feelings and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a licensed therapist. And if things don't click, you can switch to someone new at any time with no additional charge. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. And because you listen to this podcast, you can get 10% off your first month of online therapy by heading to betterhelp.com/athleticfootball. That's BETERHELP.com/athleticfootball with no spaces.
Matt, come on, roll your sleeves up. Let's talk about Dozy Mabuasi, the Nigerian businessman who wanted to buy Sheffield United. And I was fascinated by this because if he did go through with that deal, he'd have been the first ever black owner in English football, really. So history potentially being made, but not all is what it seemed.
No, I should probably just correct something in the story there. The whole, would Dozy have been the first black owner of an English football team? I think it was really more, that was very much what he was sort of trying to bring to the table, and very particularly Africa, black Africa, Nigeria. And this was very much sort of part of his pitch, that it would sort of signal this, one, you know, a good news story for the UK, how open and tolerant we are, but also just the, you know, the rise of Africa, you know, Nigeria being a significant player on the global stage, blah, 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 you know, kind of changing the narrative around Nigerian businessmen. However, he wouldn't have been the first black owner of an English football team. Ben Robinson owns Burton. He owns 98% of Burton. So, you know, respect to Ben. He does a fantastic job there. Right. Dozy, of all the things I said in my first answer, is probably the most complicated scam. And I really feel like I've only told a sort of fraction of the story. You know, we are a football outlet and I focused on Dozy and his attempt to buy Sheffield United, but it's a big scam. And I think, you know, I know there are some people already writing about it, you know, the most notable being Hindenburg Research, who really took him down. Now, they are short sellers. They take bets on companies that they don't rate. They look for frauds and they bet against the share price. And they absolutely took Dozy and his company Tingo down. Others were already on it. A guy called Tom Winifred, who writes, you know, he's the same sort of thing. He writes for a site called Share Profit. So he was an early, he got onto Dozy quickly. Now, he's simple, though, for our purposes, in that I think he hasn't been convicted yet, but the DOJ success rate is remarkable, and the SEC have jumped on with a civil suit, and there's a 72-page indictment there. There's a 9-page indictment from the DOJ. I've spoken to at least a dozen people that were sort of unfortunate enough to work for Dozy. They're all owed money. It's at least a 4 or 5 year scam, the American part of it, but he's been a grifter all his life. And look, I should probably add that certainly with Dozy, you know, he does deny the allegations against him. What he was trying to do, I think, was a pump and dump share scam. And he was using football. And I've got to be honest here, football journalists who can be a little bit sort of, you know, we're all rushed. We're all trying to sort of, you know, get stories out there. And sometimes we don't have time to do background checks, particularly if it's a news story. And there is a bit of a habit of somewhat of just saying, well, there's a billionaire that wants to buy his football club. Boom, that's the story, isn't it? Oh, he's a Nigerian billionaire. Oh, he's a tech billionaire. oh, he's got a company over that's on NASDAQ that's worth $7 billion. Suddenly it's like becomes a bit of an arms race to sort of big up your story, because that's what people want to hear, right? Oh, my football club that's in trouble is going to be bought by a billionaire. Not just a billionaire, this guy's got $5 billion. Oh, right. So there was a bit of that. And that every time someone wrote that, that's a positive story about him. It's a free advert for his company that he has just done a reverse merger with another rubbish company, and they're on NASDAQ, so he's going to be selling shares, right? So he's in sales mode. So the number of times he gets people to say he's a billionaire is just a win. And it was a remarkable number. It started before the connection with Sheffield United, to be fair. So he managed to get himself photographed in GQ Africa. He had this foundation. He threw a ball at Dorchester. He got Naomi Campbell there. He got famous Nigerian politicians there. He got Akon there. And he convinced a lot of people. Sheffield United was just part of it. In some ways, to go to Adam's answer before, I think it might have been a tactical mistake, though. I think the grift, which was talking up Tingo, this magic African conglomerate that does everything from mobile phones to food to healthcare, and was going to expand all over Africa and get into Asia. That was the grift, right? And he had co-conspirators in that. And the football bit did actually attract attention. So he got that burst of publicity. You know, CNN, the BBC did him. Rio Ferdinand did him. Loads of people did him. The Times. Lots of people told his story. But it did shine a big light on him. And it got people like me, and not just me, quite a few people going, well, hold on a minute. I've never heard of Tingo. I'm going to run it by my Nigerian mate. Have you heard of a company called Tingo that apparently has got 9 million customers? No, never heard of them. Right. Well, apparently he's opening a hospital and he's got a foundation and a business school. No, I've genuinely never heard of the bloke. And he's running around telling people he's a Nigerian billionaire. There are, according to Forbes, which, you know, isn't perfect, but it's quite good at billionaires. There are 4 Nigerian billionaires and he wasn't one of them. It wasn't that hard to start going, Dozy, I'm just not sure about these claims. And then you start looking at Tingo, and every single number it had was an estimate or a forecast. You think, none of these numbers have been audited. These are huge red flags. How many red flags?
Matt, I want to ask you, why do you think, because if you look at US sports, this doesn't happen in US sports, right? In the way that it does with English football. Why do you think English football is uniquely both vulnerable and attractive to some of these characters?
Well, I'm actually trying to write a story about this right now. So the first thing to say is, you're right, English football does appear, football in general, but we'll stick to English because we got a lot of clubs and a lot of high profile and there's a lot of money sloshing around. So it does appear that it's uniquely, but particularly, especially if you like, vulnerable. I would just say there's a very famous case in the US, New Islanders, and a guy called Spano. I think it was a 30 for 30, you know, a massive fraud. And he actually got away with it for a bit. He was rumbled eventually, but it can happen. Not as often, of course. And there's famous other scams from other sports. Alan Stanford springs to mind in cricket. And funnily enough, while I was just sort of researching my list of wrong-uns, there's quite a bit of crossover with F1. So one of our guys in our series, William Story, of course, was connected with Haas and the Notts County guy, Russell King, which is one of the earliest scams I ever reported on when I was at the BBC. He also, I think, put a bid in for Sauber. And there's a couple others. I mean, Flavio Briatore, QPR and Benetton team. So that's interesting. So there's another sport there, European, their teams. You generally buy a team. There's a lot of cash. What are the, you know, both have in common? I think it's just cash businesses, the profile is high, the checks and balances done by whoever's in charge. Who is in charge? Who's in charge of F1? Well, they're just a collection of F1 owners, right? So there isn't really a body there that's vetting everybody. What is football? Well, the leagues are just the shareholders of the clubs. They don't want to create this high bar for people to come in, because they have at some point they've got to sell the clubs themselves. So they don't want to frighten people off. That's, I think, a common theme through this. And broadly speaking, in English football, and I remember I interviewed Richard Scudamore about this a few years ago, where he sort of said to me, I think it was the whole piece is around the owners and directors test, which they used to call the fit and proper person test. And he didn't like that. He didn't like the fit and proper person name. But he said it sounds like a cut of your jib test. It sounds like sort of like you're trying to join a country club. And he wanted what we have here in the UK to be based in law, more objective, more black and white. And he drew the distinction with US sport, where it is a cut of your jib test. So the NFL, you try and buy an NFL club, is really hard. The other NFL owners vet you, like you are trying to join a gang, trying to join a country club. And you could be blackballed. Now, he says, we don't want to do that. We want to have a test that is based in law, British law. And broadly speaking, if you can own a British company, you can probably own a British football team as well. That, if you like, is sort of admirable from a kind of legal and commercial point of view, in that it is based in law. You can't just have, so I don't like the look of you. Well, let's have something a bit more black and white, please, a bit more objective. But it does, it is almost by design, a low bar. Now, what they've done in, maybe we'll get into this, and this is, I think, one of the key takeaways from our series. Most of these guys didn't actually succeed. You know, the ones we've written about actually failed. And, you know, I've got a list of 15, 20 others who ultimately were rumbled. They either got caught or they had the club for a while and then they lost it. Not many people kind of got away with it. Now, that means that football must be doing something right. And in particularly on Kirshner, on Dozy, on William Story, they did a pretty good job. They didn't take these guys seriously. They vetted them. They held it up. They demanded proof of funds. They demanded source and sufficiency of funding. And this is where football, I think, is doing a better job. It is sort of saying, well, look, we've got our black and white test. You either fail that or you don't. Show me the money to prove to me that you can be a good owner. That's where people are falling up now, falling down now.
Yeah, I was just thinking, actually, this brings us quite well into sort of the ongoing proposed takeover of Everton, you know, 777 Partners, Matt. Is it this scrutiny that's delaying that from happening at this moment in time?
Well, I don't want to rabble on too long because I felt that one went on too long, that last answer. So I'm gonna let Adam jump in a bit. But look, but broadly speaking, yes, right? There isn't really a black and white owners and directors issue with 777. Do you remember right at the beginning, people talked about the fact that Josh Wander, who's basically the majority owner at 777, had a sort of a cocaine conviction from his student days. That was a spent conviction and really wouldn't be a problem. That was a bit of a red herring. For 777, it is all about, show me the money. What's your business plan? Can you fund and run this complicated club, this big complicated club with issues for 2-3 years? Yes or no? Can you do it?
I mean, the fact it's not happened yet, I think, is revealing. My expectation throughout this whole thing is that it wouldn't happen because it's not happened yet, in the sense of, this club really needs to be taken over fast, right? And the Premier League know that. And the closer you get towards the end of the season, where Everton may have another points deduction, Everton could be relegated in a matter of, what, 2 months? If Everton are relegated and you've got that stadium burden over them, and the owner, Moshiri, obviously has this loan to MSP as well that could potentially default. There's a lot of issues coming down the train tracks, both for Everton and the Premier League. And I understand why some Everton fans will just be thinking, just get on with it and we'll deal with whatever's coming, right? Once they're in the building. But actually, if the Premier League were to do that and then it was all to go wrong, we'd kill them for not doing the right due diligence, for not doing the right checks, for not doing the right process. You know, this is a famous football club. It's a historic football club. It's a founder member of the Premier League, you know, and as a result of that, I think the Premier League are increasingly getting these things right when it comes to the scrutiny they're applying on takeovers. And yes, at the same time, you'll always have people with some merit who will say things like, okay, but, you know, you gave the Newcastle takeover through in the end and you've not dealt with Man City and you've not done this and you've not done this. And, you know, look at what happened with Chelsea and all of that kind of thing. And I suppose that all makes the argument for getting it right now even stronger, really, because you don't want another one of those sort of coming down the line where you're saying, we just got on with it and found a way through it. So my instinct is still, if it's taken this long, I wonder why it's not happened, right? It's a bit like with a VAR decision, right? If they're taking that long over it, there's probably something not right about it.
On the other hand, Matt, you do also think about stuff that's happened with Bury, Macclesfield, you know, Derby County, and you have a chairman who's basically had enough and gone, right, I'm done. Adios. I mean, what can protect clubs from that as well? You know, they've washed their hands over it, right? Well, we've got it to liquidation. Sorry. Next.
Yeah, it's really, really, really hard. And, you know, there's quite a list there. I mean, You know, Bury is a good example of what I think Adam's getting at with 777. Now, I'm not suggesting 777 are going to fall apart. I'm just saying that this is a potential thought. Bury were already in trouble. The previous owner, I think, was called Stuart Day. They'd been running too hot. They'd gone up. He'd lost control of the finances. He'd lost control of his own personal business. And a guy called Steve Dale came along. Now, Steve Dale should never have been allowed to buy that club. But at that time, there was the football's light touch approach to vetting owners was particularly light. And there was a classic case of, you know, frying pan fire there. 1 year after Steve Dale's ownership of Bury, they were out of the league, effectively bankrupt. He's actually now declared bankruptcy. And, you know, we know what happened to Bury. They sort of basically disappeared. And they're, you know, thank God a Phoenix team started. But why did we go through that? You know, why was Dale allowed to do that? What was his plan? What was it really about? You know, people talk about it now, and you know, what was he trying to do there? Was it a property scam? Was it about the car park? Who knows? It's all a bit small time. And I can give you another 10, 15 clubs where the same thing's happened, where they've been caught almost in a vicious cycle of bad owners. The club is permanently a distressed asset, right? So good owners steer clear, and you only get kind of wrong-uns. And what does football do about that? Does it say no, 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 no? Well, okay, if you keep doing that, the club goes bust. They're just companies at the end of the day. I know fans don't want to hear that, but that's how they're set up. That's how they're structured. And companies fail all the time. You know, think about your favourite nightclubs when you were young. They've all gone. They don't last. FTSE 100, go back 25 years, 50 years, 75 years. See how much it's changed. This is the nature of business. Football clubs are weird in that they're incredibly sticky. They nearly always find a way. They very rarely go bust. But when they do, it's horrible. So trying to police all of that is difficult. I've been writing about this stuff for a long time, and my sympathy levels have risen for administrators and for people and for the middlemen, for the banks have to check this stuff. One thing that people often sort of get upset about is, well, I've shown proof of funds. Well, it's been explained to me very clearly now that showing proof of funds is actually not that hard. There's about 18 different varieties of proof of funds. It can be a screenshot. You can get people to loan you money for fractions of a second. You can pay for that privilege. Oh, look, I had 10 billion in my account for 3 seconds. And here's the screenshot. People get fooled all the time. We talked about Chris Kirchner, who's the guy that very nearly bought Derby and, you know, kicked the tires at Preston as well. The basis of his wealth was a startup company. It went through rounds of venture capital funding. It had an interesting idea, particularly, you know, in the time it was a logistics company. And it was, you know, it got people at Goldman Sachs, gave it money. They liked the idea. That's the nature of startups, right? You know, you get people to invest in you because you've got a good story to tell. So he had money, he had an idea. Serious, credible people had given his company money. Now, he then misappropriated and used that and misused that money. And he's heading to prison. But for a while, he was legitimate. And with that money, he hired really good lawyers. He had one of the best football takeover lawyers working for him. You know, when he rocks up to the EFL and they see him sat next to a really good lawyer and they look at his company and they can sort of see some auditor. He had a good auditor. You know, they can see the fact that Goldman Sachs have given them money. Oh, wow. He's got employees. They've got revenue. As far as they were concerned, it was like, Chris, you can have the club. Just can you send the money? Actually do the deal. We've said you can do, you know, the deal is done as far as we're concerned. And this happens quite a lot. It's sort of like, yeah, you pass our test. We can see you're not a convicted fraudster. You haven't got two bankruptcies. You're not in trouble with another governing body. There's no gambling convictions. All right, fine. All the black and white stuff. You're okay. Yeah. We like your lawyer. We like your plan. Can you send the money now, please? And that's where a lot of these deals fall down. But it is hard. If you rock up with a good lawyer, and you've got some, you know, a decent bank behind you. But people fall like this all the time. It's not just football. Trust me. You know, there are scams. There are scams. Turn on Netflix. There are quite a few scammers out there.
This is the Athletic FC podcast with Ayo Akinwolele.
There are scams that people play on older, vulnerable people. And I sort of see, Adam, these sort of lower league clubs as that sort of vulnerable state. You've lost everything. Your club's pretty much gone into liquidation of some sort. You're desperate for someone to rescue them. And in comes these guys who are just like, well, yeah, we've got the lawyers, we've got the funds. What do you say?
They are your NAM receiving a cold phone call saying, you know, I can get you a free holiday. And there is an element of that to it. I think it must be so, you know, we so often criticize the Premier League and the EFL. I mean, I wonder now, like, I mean, how big those departments or how big those costs must be when you're talking about this level of due diligence, because when they do get it wrong, the cost is so big reputationally and emotionally. And even when an owner is right from a legal perspective, it can still all go wrong, right? It can go wrong once you're in the building, even if you are a legitimate owner as well. That's the other part of this, right? You can be a legitimate owner and become hated and unpopular and seen as destroying football from within and all this sort of stuff. So even when the EFL do their jobs right, some people will still say, how have they let them in? So that is another one of those challenges. And you wonder as well, you know, who now do like the EFL and the Premier League Commission, you know, when they do these background checks and this auditing? I mean, that there must be quite a lot to be made in the kind of subtle private investigation space. So maybe that might be your next move.
Adam, you make a great point. I mean, we talk about fit and proper owners, directors, whatever they want to call it. How do you check for competence? So Mel Morris was about the most perfect owner walking into Derby County, local boy made good, ludicrously rich, respected in business, and really went for it for a few years until he ran out of money, until he could no longer keep paying those bills. And this goes, there's a whole list of genuine white knights, the funder, you know, the owner funding, you know, and it's great when it works. There's often a sort of strong family connection and it's brilliant. And then they die, their business goes bang, they get bored, they get fed up with, you know, the unfairness of it all. And that funding's taken away. And then you're left with a club that is just unsustainable, a company that's unsustainable. So, you know, you talk about the vulnerability. Why does this keep happening to football? I think it's probably, you know, a really sort of fundamental question about the industry. It keeps happening to football because we're talking about much-loved, high-profile, highly scrutinized businesses where people get a bit carried away. They get, you know, they get the sugar rush, they get the... But they're not profitable. They're barely sustainable. Most of them are insolvent.
And Matt, we expect them to be here forever, right? So whereas, as you said, you know, businesses rise, businesses fall. It's very sad when that happens, but you don't have that, you know, Woolworths, right? If you're listening in the UK, right? Like imagine 25 years ago, a world without Woolworths, right? But people aren't, well, maybe you get some people who are still mourning Woolworths, but most people now just go and get their stuff from other places. You can't do that with a football club. And so take a club like Wigan. They had what many people thought was a kind of a perfect ownership. Local guy, Dave Whelan, cared about his town, cared about his club, invested in Wigan Athletic, was into his rugby as well. But his problem was what was going to happen as he got older. And it was in the end, you know, it kind of his grandson got involved and he just couldn't sustain the cost of it, and they didn't want to sustain the cost of it. There came a point where the family wanted to move on from it, and unfortunately they made a really, really, you could say, bad choice in the sale that they made, but equally it was approved at the time, it looked right at the time, everything, that there was a business plan that looked good, and it nearly drove them out of business in the end. So I think the longevity of clubs as well is another problem. The fact that these clubs have to exist forever and won't remain under the same ownership forever. So even if your club, you know, what happened to Brighton, for example, when one day Tony Bloom decides he's had enough? Brentford, you know, we've heard recently, might be on the market. These clubs that we say are so perfectly run, they are now sort of major, you know, pretty major clubs in the sense of English football. So you'd expect they would get some form of decent bidders coming in, but there's no guarantee of, as Matt says, of the competence. And, you know, we're seeing that with Chelsea. You know, when you looked at that Todd Bowley bid, when he came in, you know, owned sports teams in the States, backed by Clear Lake Capital, you know, yeah, of course. Look, some people would have looked at it and thought, well, not sure if they know that much about soccer. But I think most people looked at it and thought, it's probably as good as you're going to get in that situation, right, where you are basically up for auction. And now you've got, they're kind of being caricatured on cartoons as absolute amateurs. And that just shows at every level of the game there. So we're talking, you know, from Chelsea to Bury, you're talking about different questions. First of all, the legality, then the approval, but then the bit that nobody can really ever test for is competence.
Matt, so what is in it for then, if you are legitimately wanting to buy a lower league team? Is it the kudos of taking them up to the Premier League? I want something for the fans. Can we keep some dreams alive, please?
Yeah, no, sure. Absolutely. And again, we've done pods on this, haven't we? So look, we've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, all the bad stuff, and you know, and let's be honest, bad news tends to do quite well. And we really could do 2 or 3 weeks of this stuff, 3, 4, 5 weeks of this stuff. I was reminded of stories I'd forgotten about, you know, that I, Notts County, Munto, Russell King, Croydon Athletic, and was his name Mazar Majid, and the whole Pakistani cricket scandal that was all connected to that. Really sad story, you know, someone involved in that club committed suicide over it, you know, took their own life over it because they were so horrified about what happened to their club. And I think there was a similar situation at Oxford United, or was it Oxford City as well? I can't remember, one of those clubs. You know, really sad stories, you know, terrible impacts. So, you know, that's all the bad stuff. Why are people attracted to football? Well, because of everything I said at the beginning, you know, it's exciting. People come to it because they, you know, they're competitive. They've been successful in one sphere of their life. They want to be competitive somewhere else. They've reached a sort of point in their life when they have a bit of fun. Some of them want to give something back. You know, they are genuinely, you know, proud of their area. They used to support this club. It's sort of, you know, again, that whole kind of, you know, the benefactor. Philanthropy, you know, some of them are trying to sort of polish their reputation for whatever reason. There's lots of reasons to do it. And at the bottom end, we are seeing this enormous boost in interest in the bottom end. And I think there's a few reasons. One, our pyramid's really deep. That's very much our USP. You know, we have lots of clubs with great fan bases, great stories to tell. They have amazing longevity, these clubs. They don't, you know, they are built to last, but believe it or not, they're resilient. I think things like, we've got to be honest, Ted Lasso, Wrexham, Sunderland Till I Die, this real interest in the story, the narrative. What do we have that, if you like, North American football, North American sport doesn't have? We have Jeopardy, promotion, relegation, snakes and ladders. It's there's interest and excitement at both ends. It's very different to the way North American sport is structured. So that's interesting. There's an awful lot. I mean, again, we get into sort of kind of economic structural stuff. You know, there's a lot of money swashing around out there. We had low interest rates for a while. Private equity, where does that money go? There's interesting returns in sports. Sports become an asset class. I mean, that's another whole podcast. You know, people are making serious monies in sport in North America. Then you've got the whole interest, of course, from the other side of the world. What's the, you know, the Gulf interest, and prior to that, China. So there's always going to be an amount of money out there that is going to be interested in sport, entertainment, that kind of cross section, whatever that is. And people care about sport. And when people care about something and are willing to pay for something, there's always going to be a business case for it. And I think the interest at the bottom end is, to me, is fascinating, because I think people really quite like the promotion, relegation, the pyramid story. They love the idea. The clubs are cheaper down there. They're available. There's lots of them. And you can go on a journey if you get it right. So, you know, here's a good news story from the other day. I hope it seems good news to me, and I hope it continues to be good news. Ipswich Town. All right. So Ipswich Town were one of these sort of, you know, kind of stalled clubs, sleeping giants, whatever you want to describe them. A US pension fund bought them. Now, at the time, people were like, hold on a minute. Why is the Arizona sort of, you know, public fireman's and policeman's pension fund buying Ipswich Town, particularly when they're in League One and paying quite a good price for it, you know, quite a big price for it? Well, they get promoted. They're well run. There's a good vibe about them. They might go up this season to the Premier League. Wow. They've just sold 40% of the club. That values them at £260 million. That's a remarkable figure to pay for Ipswich Town. And an incredible, you know, uplift already in this pension fund's bet. And by the way, they've sold it, that 40%, to another American private equity firm who are clearly looking at it and going, yeah, I like that bet. So look, you know, there are good news stories out there. You know, there's Rochdale, thankfully, I think, are going to end up, you know, with a good local owner. They've been through the mill, and those tyres have been kicked by quite a few rogues and rascals as well. So there are good stories out there.
All right, let's end it there, gents. I really appreciate your time, Matt, Adam. And also don't forget to check out the series Men Who Want to Buy English Football Clubs on The Athletic right now. Don't forget to rate and review us. And Michael and the team will be back tomorrow for the weekend preview. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Athletic FC podcast. The producers were Guy Clark, Mike Stavrou and Jay Beale. The executive producer was Amy Moorhead. To listen to other great Athletic podcasts for free, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places. The Athletic FC podcast is an Athletic Media Company production.
The Athletic.